Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
The following program has some offensive language. Though none of us would be here without the verb deployed, it's thought by many better not to hear the verb deployed. It's Monday, September 12th, 2022, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Do Americans really care that much about the Queen? The people who program TV networks seem to think so. ABC blew out its primetime coverage for wall-to-wall Queen programming this Thursday. I guess that sounds impressive, but primetime programming, it's a little like long-distance call or Republican Party, greatly diminished in the last 20 years. When I tell you that the primetime programming that was to air was Kelly Ripa hosting a game show where grandkids and grandparents compete called Generation Gap, a Whoopi Goldberg hosted Dateline NBC ripoff about ripoffs called The Con, and a redo of Press Your Luck, you'll see what primetime programming really means. Press Your Luck. I guess the Queen's passing proves that the whammy inevitably comes for us all. I was accused of, see, whammy reference, of being disrespectful and in poor taste for my previous Queen comments. This is unfounded. I was not disrespectful at all. I was disinclined to give into the hushed tones of international weeks-long mourning that seems like network knee-jerk obligation. I was possibly irreverent, but as an American, it is my birthright and something of my responsibility to not have reverence for the sovereign whose house we threw off the shackles of years ago. Yes, thus allowing us to keep shackles on our own people longer than they'd have decreed. That is true. I acknowledge it. But still, I don't need to show reverence. I showed no cruelty. I bear no hostility. I am, however, allergic to the wall-to-wall cable and network tone of deep solemnity and whispered supplicancy that accompanies these events. Like every anniversary of 9/11, which I would never mock, but the obligatory nature of using it as an ongoing national moment which circumvents the usual nature of history. We act, well, our network newscasters, our newspapers, we act like 9/11 stands outside the flow of cause and event and reaction. It's still treated as quasi-holy. And so it was this Sunday, the 21st anniversary of 9/11, covered quite extensively by all the Sunday shows, except one actually, ABC. Here is the entirety of ABC's this week's 9/11 coverage.
That was the scene at Ground Zero just a short time ago. It's been 21 years since the 9/11 attacks. Queen Elizabeth once said right afterwards, "Grief is the price we pay for love." That was her message of support after that attack.
Because 90% of this week was Queen, Queen, Queen. The main anchor was in London. The show gave itself over to the passing of a monarch who will be missed, but also quite easily replaced, unless Charles screws it up. However, I am not anti-queen. I am not anti-monarchy for Britain. And it does seem like the Brits quite liked their queen and the institution of the monarchy. And so you know what? I defer to their national preference for them. The best argument against the Queen or any institution in expenditure is a cost-benefit analysis. The benefit is a bit of continuity from the past, a dignified figure who can perform ceremonial duties, which frees up politicians who have to do the actual work. But what's the cost? It's literally an expenditure from the national treasury as funded by the people. So I looked it up, and it turns out the total taxpayer-funded sovereign grant, which funds all of the royal family, is 86.3 million pounds. 51.8 of that is core funding and an extra 34.5 million pounds for refurbishment of Buckingham Palace, which is the sort of expenditure that Americans might have to or be asked to or forced to undertake when they refurbish the Smithsonian or the White House when that happens, maybe a national park. £1, 49 pence for every Brit to have a royal family. it seems like it's worth it. You can even tell the royal family that they're entitled to the jewels. They can feel like they own something really valuable. It's not like anyone was going to make any money off the royal jewels anyway. You keep them in a ceremonial case in a museum. You tell a bunch of people, oh, yeah, they quote unquote belong to you. It's an easy way of getting off funding a lifestyle. You know, Netflix in Britain is £10.99. I don't know how much tuppence. I guess it would be twice as much. But £10.99, standard subscription in the UK. So we're talking to fund a queen is the same as 4 days of Netflix. Or subscription to the Daily Mail, £65 a year. It auto-renews at £99. So the first year is 8 days of the Daily Mail, and you get a queen. 12 days in subsequent years for a queen. And her whole family. That's actually less of a package deal and more of a millstone. Anyway, the question is, would you go, not even you, but your cousin in Britain, would you go 12 days without the Daily Mail to have a nice queen? It's kind of a Mobius strip question because about a third of the Daily Mail's coverage is the royal family at any one time. Also, you can argue that you might pay to go without the Daily Mail. And then there's the notion of the people who experience it at £65 a year and say, you know what, jack my price 50%, having been exposed to a year's worth of the Daily Mail. For the queen, I'd say it's worth it, especially if you're judging against 8 days of the tabloid that brings us the headline today. Nicola Sturgeon says her husband saved one of the queen's corgis from being electrocuted after it began chewing through a lamp switch. Thank God. And like I said, Daily Mail, monarchy, a bit like a Mobius strip. On the show today, prestige in the international stage for the United States, a country that does have a Donald Trump. Oh, and iTunes, why not go to that podcast app and give us a review? Everyone else will tell you it helps people find the show. I doubt that's true. I think listening all the way through or much of the way through actually helps you. But if you would leave a written review, it doesn't have to be 5 stars. 4 is okay. I just don't like the 1 star based on, you know, one day I tried to fire it up and it didn't work. Or a little pet peeve, you know, Mike Pesca is a guy who has it in for corgis, that sort of thing. But first, most Americans were quite surprised by the insurrection on January 6th. Most Americans does not include my next guest. Luke Mogelson was shocked by what he saw from the rioting crowd at the Capitol, but he was right inside of it, and he had been chronicling those rioters and would-be rioters for many years. He's a reporter for The New Yorker and came ready to cover something big on January 6th. It's all part of his new book, The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. Luke Mogelson, up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Luke Mogelson has been writing for The New Yorker since 2013 in that capacity and beforehand with The New York Times Magazine. He's been to war zones, foreign and domestic. So this means not just Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, but also Minneapolis after George Floyd, Portland when Antifa protesters beset the courthouse, and of course, the January 6th riots. You saw his footage that he took for the New Yorkers inside the Senate chamber. There was the QAnon shaman holding forth.
Yeah! This is crazy.
which we got a glimpse of because of Luke's documentary style. He talks to the protesters slash militia members and makes us understand what really is going on here. His new book is called The Storm Is Here, An American Crucible. Luke Mogelson, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks so much for having me.
From reporting in the actual war zones, is that where the idea of reporting for these domestic units sprang up? It just seemed natural. It seemed to you or editors that there was overlap between what you were seeing there and what was brewing here?
Certainly, once I saw reports in the spring early on in the pandemic of anti-lockdowners mobilizing at state capitals with flak jackets, Kevlar helmets, and assault rifles, I was interested to learn more about where that was coming from. And I had no idea, obviously, at the time where it would lead. But it was enough. I'm even just visually, there were enough kind of echoes with some of my foreign correspondents for me to feel like it was worth coming home and checking out.
Right. So you're speaking to me from France now. Had you already covered those yellow vest riots of 2018?
Yeah, I was living in Paris at the time, and certainly, I wasn't gonna just stay home for those protests and riots. So I went out a few times and reported on them.
Right. So there are waves of populism besetting the Western world, and you could look to those riots. I mean, in the UK, they think that Bill Gates is foisting 5G upon us. But Michigan and Lansing, where protesters took over the state capitol, is the big difference between this sentiment that's sweeping the world and how it's expressed here in the United States? Is the big difference the fact that the protesters here are armed?
That's certainly one big difference.
Yeah. And you saw that in Michigan. Now, when you were there, and this was the first protest slash insurrection you were covering, were you there with the mindset, I've got to cover this event, or I want to understand the subculture, and I want to... Did you have an inkling that perhaps the contacts you were making at that event would come into play over the course of the next couple of years?
No, absolutely not. I had no idea. First of all, because I went there and started spending time with them and reporting on these groups and movements before George Floyd was killed. And, you know, the subsequent uprising against for racial justice and police accountability really changed the posture and purpose of these groups that had previously been organizing around opposing lockdown measures.
Right. And so when did it become apparent to you that, or did it become apparent to you even after the events transpired, that this might not be a one-off thing?
You know, honestly, I was pretty surprised as soon as I showed up in Michigan by how heated and bellicose the rhetoric was among, you know, all of the pretty much everyone I talked to that was upset about the lockdown and pandemic policies. And even then in May, people were telling me, you know, we're only a trigger pull away. That I met people that were actually in Michigan that were en route to DC because they were worried about a coup by, you know, globalist pedophiles and agents of the New World Order. So it was definitely in the water, and the terrain was ripe to be exploited for, you know, larger scale violence.
And so when you encountered that, there is so much of their philosophy is ridiculous. Some of it isn't, even if the means that they pursue to get redress is extreme. Do you say to yourself, this is ridiculous and dangerous? Or do you emphasize one over the other? How do you process that, and then how do you communicate that to the audience?
That's a good question, and it's difficult because, you know, you don't want to spend too much time getting into the nuances and the nitty gritty of, you know, why one person thinks that the Satanists are telling us their secret plans in coded language in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and why, you know, somebody else thinks that germ theory was implanted by a Jewish cabal in the Middle Ages. And, you know, it's kind of a slippery slope once you really start trying to understand the specifics of these theories. I think it's more useful to try to articulate why they appeal to people.
Right. And you even went so far as to make a spreadsheet to try to make sense of all the theories. And that was kind of a wasted time. But was there one through line you hit upon?
Well, the through line was basically that for all of these theories, whether it was, you know, the New World Order or Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci concocting the virus or 3G towers spreading it, the through line for all of this stuff was whatever the conspiracy was, its ultimate purpose was to prevent Trump from being reelected.
So you were there in Michigan and then the summer of 2020 post George Floyd, but you also were at some of the precursors to the January 6th insurrection, which I want to get to. But what did you see on, I think it was December 12th and before that, law enforcement certainly and much of the rest of the public weren't seeing?
So there was a rally on November 14th and December 12th again. The November 14th one was the Million MAGA March, and I attended both of them. I was stunned on November 14th by how many people showed up to show support for then President Trump. I'd really never seen anything like that, and you had all kinds of people from across the right, extremists like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the America Firsters, 3%ers, different militias, Joey Gibson's group from Portland, but also just a lot of quote unquote normal mainstream conservatives that had become convinced that, you know, the election had been stolen and they were victims of this historic grave injustice. And at both events, basically what happened was during the day, there were speeches and marches and some kind of more out there than others. And then at night, there was violence and vandalism. And a lot of these groups who would go on to attack law enforcement at the Capitol on January 6th and storm the building, they were basically running roughshod over downtown DC, vandalizing and attacking historic Black churches, vandalizing gay-owned businesses, heckling, harassing, and assaulting Black pedestrians and cyclists. It was really, really ugly. And, you know, we didn't, I think law enforcement, the media, the public, really missed it and didn't pay nearly enough attention to what was happening on those two nights at the Capitol.
So I want to ask you about your tactics of who you talk to and who you make contact with. So Joey Gibson, who we talked about, what about some of these other leaders of Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Gripers, or any of the other groups?
Well, for almost all of these scenes in the book, whether it was Gibson or you know, Enrique Tarrio, the national chairman of the Proud Boys, or his deputy, Joe Biggs, or Nicholas Fuentes, the leader of this white nationalist group called the Gripers. It wasn't as if I had some special access to them or was hanging out with them, you know, at their homes or at the bar. I simply showed up to all of their public events and recorded what they said and recorded what they did. And the scenes in the book are just basically direct transcriptions of their actions and words that I witnessed firsthand, but in public settings.
Did they know who you were with? Did they care?
Especially in Michigan, I was introducing myself to everybody, and including the militia leaders. And sometimes they would, indulge me with a few questions. And same in Portland with the Proud Boys and Vancouver. Less so in D.C., just because, honestly, it was kind of a dangerous, if just the energy felt kind of a little wild and dangerous. And I didn't necessarily want to out myself while these people were basically committing crimes in front of me. So yeah, it was a mix. But generally, I have to say that when I did introduce myself as a journalist, as a reporter for the New Yorker magazine, people were cordial with me, polite. I didn't really experience too much hostility.
Well, they're not naive. They want publicity. And another thing to consider is that, so there is media there who's extremely sympathetic, right? Alex Jones's crew was there and I watched hours of footage from them. The people committing crimes are just as easily identifiable on a camera shot by an Alex Jones crew member as on a camera shot by Luke Mogelson.
That's true. And that makes actually my job a lot easier because if you go to these things, whether it's an Antifa rally in Portland or a Proud Boys event in DC or wherever, everybody has their cell phones out.
Yeah.
And everybody's, live streaming or filming or taking selfies. And it was the same on January 6th. Why so many people are in jail right now.
Yeah. And that was not an action characterized by anyone wanting to cover their tracks. I mean, you tell this great anecdote. You're in the buffet line after all the events take place on January 6th. And some guy starts talking about how peaceful he and his mom are. Turns out that's the infamous zip tie guy who wasn't peaceful at all, who assaulted the Capitol. And you're, Cracker Jack journalism was literally just being next to him eating a buffet.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of hard to remember this, but it's important to keep in mind that, at the time and throughout 2020, all of these people, the true believers and fanatics that were showing up to these events, and especially the ones that were enamored enough of Trump to, commit felonies on his behalf, they thought that he was going to retain power. They thought that, Biden was not going to be sworn in, and that there would, and some of them, like the QAnon followers, genuinely believed that there would be this kind of day of reckoning that they called the storm, and followed by the Great Awakening.
Yeah.
So considering their worldview, it's not so surprising that they were as unconcerned as they were about, incriminating themselves with video and photographic evidence.
Right. And as you said, it was perfectly legal for them to enter and occupy the Michigan State House with guns. The commander in chief was giving them signals all along that this is the right thing to do. They were live streaming, yelling, "We're taking back the people's house," obviously thinking this was the right thing to do, maybe even a sanctioned thing to do. "We're making a citizen's arrest." There was nothing in their mindset that would indicate that they were committing any sort of wrong for which they would get punished. And in fact, you could also tie in what you just talked about, how December 12th and the Million MAGA March weren't even precedent. There wasn't even a huge police presence on January 6th because it didn't seem that too many people were taking it too seriously.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the unpreparedness of the DC police on January 6th was all the more shocking for me because I had been at the November 14th and December 12th events, just like those cops had.
Yeah.
And, the Park Police, the Metropolitan Police, the Capitol Police, they were all in the middle of these melees in November and December. And by the way, at those events, there was a real turn among Trump supporters who had mobilized around backing the blue since the murder of George Floyd in DC on November 14th and December 12th. That switched because the police that were there, they were doing their jobs and they were, as best as they could, trying to at least separate the more violent contingents of the Trump supporters from the counter protesters to avoid, you know, massive brawls in downtown DC.
Yeah.
And that absolutely enraged the Trump supporters. And I heard, you know, many of the same insults hurled at the DC police by Trump supporters at those events that I had heard lobbed at Portland police by anti-fascists over the summer and the fall. Defund the police, you know, yeah.
Put the gun in your mouth, traitor, all that.
Yeah. So they knew, the DC cops knew who they were dealing with. They had encountered them firsthand, not once, but twice, by the time January 6th came around.
So there we leave Luke as January 6th came around. He knew he was on the precipice of ugliness. Not sure he knew that it would be so literally true. Tomorrow, we will join Luke as he swept along by the crowd, to the Capitol, through smashed windows, and as he becomes the first journalist to document the breach of the Senate floor. Tomorrow on The Gist, the storm is here.
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode. We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
And now the spiel. Kamala Harris was on Meet the Press answering questions about the president calling Republicans semi-fascists, her thoughts about running if Joe Biden doesn't, and if the filibuster should go. She used the usual rhetorical technique of answering the question she wanted to answer, not always the question that was asked, and she did so with a certain pivot word.
What is a semi-fascist?
Listen, I think that let's not get caught up in politicizing the fact that
is the Democratic Party making a mistake here by you know, those people could win if you're not careful.
I mean, listen, I'm not gonna tell people how to run their campaigns.
Have you thought through the scenarios that you might face on January 6, 2025?
Not at all. No. I mean, well, listen, what have I thought about? I have thought about the fact. You're talking about the election.
The election, yeah.
Listen, the president has been very clear that he intends to run again.
Ironically, the cumulative effect, at least on this viewer, was to tune out or to be hyper aware that a deflection was forthcoming. No great scandal in that. All politicians do it. Some just do it better than others. There was, however, one of the times I was asked to listen, and I did quite closely. I came to a slightly different conclusion than the one the vice president would have me form. The question was about threats to our democracy from within.
I have met with and I've had conversations with over 100 foreign heads of state, presidents, prime ministers, chancellors, kings. And, you know, when we as the United States walk into those rooms around the world, we have had the honor and privilege historically of holding our head up as a defender and an example of a great democracy. And that then gives us the legitimacy and the standing to talk about the importance of democratic principles, rule of law, human rights. And one of the things, though, that comes with that privilege is that we hold ourselves out to be a role model, which means the rest of the world, like any role model, watches what we do to see if it matches up with what we say.
The presence of widespread election denial in a major political figure untethered to facts certainly doesn't help the United States standing in the eyes of others, but doesn't really hurt. Who is judging the U.S. harshly for our short-term embrace but ultimate rejection of a demagogue? The U.K., fresh off Boris Johnson? France's Emmanuel Macron, who had to contend with Marine Le Pen? Maybe our adversaries, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, maybe Modi atop the world's largest democracy, or maybe our problematic allies, the Saudis. Maybe they're all looking at the U.S. as a tarnished testament to the rule of the people. I doubt it, though. And it's not just that every other country in the world is either an autocracy already or ruled by a populist or threatens to be so. It's that the United States did beat back this threat. So when Biden, Harris, Blinken, or an American emissary enters the room and communicates by word or intonation, do you believe the last guy? Do you think the other world leaders don't understand that an important aspect to democracy is that they're vulnerable to the mob, but that the current iteration of this democracy is that we overcame it? Every country to the south of us in this hemisphere doesn't need that lesson. Almost all the countries of Europe going back 70 years don't need to learn that lesson. Like a cancer survivor or a victim of domestic violence who got away from an abuser, America's ties to the undemocratic forces of MAGA might give it more credibility in a way. If you were a sprawling, complex, would-be democracy, would you want Norway or New Zealand lecturing you on the challenges of integrating an unruly public into a coherent national ethos? I think the psychology behind the appeal to the damage America has taken to its credibility is that it will land on the ears of listeners who already agree with the sentiment, preaching to the converted, which ain't nothing. It's why preachers have a job. But the argument's not going to convince the very person who's tempted to vote for an election-denying Secretary of State. In fact, the appeal to the good graces of foreign nationals, it's the very sort of argument that drives the America First crowd towards that very ranking of the countries. They, the MAGA crowd, thinks Obama made us look weak and Trump made us look strong. I think they're wrong. But telling a domestic audience they should change their views due to the opinion of foreign elites seems like it can never work. And it seems like it's not true. Now, all this might sound like an insult to the Biden/Harris administration, at least on the narrow point I'm talking about. But overall, I do think they're doing a very good job in ways the vice president only hinted at. Take this later part of her explanation.
Because there are so many issues going on in the world that I think require at least how we as Americans have traditionally thought about what is right, what is good, what should be fought for, what should be human ideals, and certainly the ideals of democracies.
That's an appeal to tradition, the traditional status of the United States as a human rights leader, which was actually really only true during a narrow period of time. The United States, for most of its existence, stuck to its own knitting, then started getting involved in world wars. And it was really only after the World War II era that the United States was seen as either a savior or a bulwark or at least the last healthy man standing. But soon thereafter, after images of the Berlin airlift faded, the United States stature as a shining city on the hill did too. There were CIA operations and wars of choice and wars of occupation and proxy wars. It didn't destroy the U.S. standing as a moral bulwark, but it did make it pretty clear we were a flawed one. But it seems we're less flawed at this moment than we have been for a while. We're no longer involved in Afghanistan. We're no longer lagging on the issue of climate change. Our military support of Ukraine is paying tangible dividends. There is strength in our moral bearing, but there's also strength in strength. The current combination of military might and prudent decision-making is a strong one on the world stage. And we seem right now to have leadership strong enough to recognize our own flaws. Of course, a Trump re-election or MAGA wave would undo all of that. But then the problem wouldn't be one of the U.S. leading. The problem under that circumstance would be where the U.S. was headed toward. Mm-hmm. And that's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the assistant producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. He passes his spins to Michelle Pesca, COO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Ooh-peru-gee-peru-doo-peru, and thanks for listening.